sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today you'll hear the conclusion of a recent interview with Peter Janney, author of the book Mary's Mosaic, The CIA Conspiracy to Murder John F. Kennedy, Mary Pinchot Mayer, and Their Vision for World Peace, which came out in 2012. And that'll be followed by part of the speech that John F. Kennedy gave in June of 1963 at American University. Peter Janney's father was in the CIA and was friends with Mary's husband, Kordmeyer, who was also in the CIA. So here's part two of the interview with Peter Janney.
Now, earlier you talked about the importance of knowing our history and knowing what happened, because if we don't, then these things keep happening and they get worse. Can you make any connections between the JFK assassination and RFK, Martin Luther King, and even 9/11?
Well, yes, I think, on the basis of evidence, I think people really need to understand that these are not random events, as the media would like to have us believe. For instance, with Martin Luther King's assassination, there's an attorney by the name of William Pepper who, in 1998, represented the King family, and in a civil action, a wrongful death lawsuit, the family sued this guy, Lloyd Jowers, and other unnamed co-conspirators. And Mr. Pepper, Attorney Pepper, took this to trial for 30 days and called over 70 witnesses. And at the end of the trial, the jury took less than an hour to come back and not only indict this guy, Lloyd Jowers, who was a former Memphis policeman, but also indicted the United States government for their complicity in Martin Luther King's assassination on the basis of evidence that was presented at the trial. So that's the thing that I want people to begin to understand, that we have been given a false narrative about what happened in these major political events. Robert Kennedy's assassination is another case in point. And again, this same attorney, William Pepper, is attempting to reopen that case and present in a judicial proceeding evidence to support that there was at least two, possibly four shooters in that assassination, and all of the bullets that struck Robert Kennedy were from behind, and Sirhan Sirhan came at him from the front. There's no way you can look at this case on the basis of evidence and again say that Sirhan is this lone nut assassin who was just crazy. It just didn't happen that way. But there has been so much suppression of information and evidence. And for that, I blame the media. The media today is largely corporate-driven. There are very few courageous, bright, shining lights out there who are willing to attempt to tell the truth. You look at someone like Chris Hedges, who was a former Pulitzer Prize writer for the New York Times. He was fired because he didn't support the war in Iraq. The same with Phil Donahue, who used to be on MSNBC. He was fired because he came out and outspoke against the war in Iraq, saying that we were being led into war under false pretenses. Of course, and everyone knows today that, in fact, that is what took place. But you see, without a free press, without a separate entity that cannot be co-opted by the national security apparatus, we're really at the mercy of what people are getting fed. And the problem is that we have an educational system that is so deteriorated that people don't understand growing up that the province of critical thinking is an essential element of any educational experience. And if people aren't being taught to think critically, then they just become spoon-fed. They'll believe anything.
Now, can you make any connections to 9/11?
Well, I have watched the 9/11 scenario very closely, and after talking with a lot of who I think are knowledgeable people, it's absolutely clear to me, again, on the basis of evidence, that those buildings were brought down by controlled demolition. And the 9/11 Commission just completely avoided this. I mean, it was a complete whitewash. And if you look at the impact of 9/11, it has given rise to a whole new era of the loss of privacy, the loss of our civil rights in terms of the kind of scrutiny that citizens now are subjected to. And so just from an initial viewpoint, it seems clearer and clearer to me that 9/11 took place as a way to, I mean, it was very Orwellian. It was a way of increasing the amount of control government had in people's life in terms of suppressing them.
Right, not just here, but around the world.
Oh, absolutely. So the Cold War is now replaced by the War on Terrorism. And the irony, of course, really intrigues me because one of the biggest terrorists in the world is the United States government. I mean, people don't understand how much terror our government really inflicts on other parts of the country. And this was Martin Luther King's, one of his main thrusts in the late 60s, of really trying to get people to see that the violence in this world really was being conducted on such a huge scale by our own government. And I think that's why they had to get rid of him, because he was increasingly such a powerful, influential figure. And he was on the verge of creating this mass movement to just have 100,000 or more people come into Washington and sit down and shut down the entire city in the late 1960s until some things got corrected. And they just weren't going to allow that.
So you talk about in the book a shadow government.
Yeah.
And so I'm assuming that that's who's behind all of these, but maybe you can elaborate on that a little bit.
Well, yes. I mean, there is a shadow government. There is a very kind of secretive cabal that is running things. I don't think the office of the presidency anymore really means that much. It's just kind of a figurehead. I think it was very clear when Obama got elected, people were going, oh boy, we got rid of George Bush, now we're going to really be able to turn things around. And he's been a huge disappointment. I think Obama really took a cold shower when he got to the White House and realized there was going to be very little he could change, because the policies that were put into place, allegedly, by his administration were already there to begin with. I mean, in some ways, the Obama presidency is even significantly more repressive than George Bush's was. It's flabbergasting to realize that, but that's what's going on. And then with what took place in terms of the financial meltdown in 2008, I think it should be a huge eye-opener for people, because the cabal that's ruling the world, so to speak, revolves around money and the manipulation of wealth. And they are in collusion with any number of governments to maintain their own power and to maintain certain stabilities where there's a very small, whether you want to call them the Illuminati or the Bilderberg Group or, it's, you know, something like that. These people, the Rockefellers, I mean, these people exist, and they have enormous, enormous control over what takes place in the world.
Can you talk a little bit about who they blamed for the murder of Mary Pinchot Meyer?
Well, they tried to blame this itinerant day laborer. His name was Ray Crump. Itinerant is the wrong word. He was married. He had five children, but he was playing hooky that day, and he happened to be down in the Towpath area in the C&O Canal in Georgetown, and he was having a little tryst with a girlfriend of his. And I believe this whole operation was set up in such a way to frame him very quickly. And what they didn't count on was this incredible, heroic African-American attorney by the name of Debbie Roundtree. She's a real legend. She's still alive, although she's in a nursing home right now. But she's a very famous attorney in Washington, D.C., and she had a number of landmark cases. But the Crump case in 1965 was probably the case that just really put her on the map. And the story of the trial is one of the chapters in my book. And so I try, and having spent a couple of years just studying the trial transcript and talking to people who knew her, I recreate what actually took place in the trial. And she just came in so well prepared, and she had already seen, just in terms of what had happened since the murder of Mary Meyer in October of 64, how they were trying to railroad this guy. But they had no real evidence. They had circumstantial evidence that never really amounted to much, and the whole kind of murder was, the picture that was painted was that, well, a black man had attempted to rape a white woman, and this was, had been a sexual assault gone awry, and that's why he had had to kill her, that kind of thing. And it was nonsense. And she just punched holes in the government's case hour after hour after hour. And I think the jury finally realized that there just wasn't any real evidence to convict this guy. And so they didn't. He was pronounced not guilty.
I remember reading that chapter and really being fascinated with her, with the lawyer.
Oh, she is such a heroic, stellar human being. And, you know, this is a case she took for free. And basically, she used her own money to defend him, and she staked her entire reputation on this case. That's what I think is so powerful about this story. Were it not for W. Rowntree, there would be no Mary Meyer story, because Crump would have been convicted. He probably would have been electrocuted or gassed or died in jail, and end of story. He committed the crime, and that was it. But it just wasn't the case. And I don't want to wreck it for your listeners, because I do think there's a very compelling story here in terms of how all this went down. And in telling that story, I wanted to give people a glimpse of just how well this organization known as the Central Intelligence Agency, or as some people say, capitalism's invisible army, how they go about doing these kinds of things. And it's very, to some degree, you remember the show, the television show Mission Impossible?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, I mean, I ran into one of the stars of that show in a travel agency in California, and I tell that story. And he told me, he said, you know, we had several ex-CIA people as writers on this series. So the kinds of scenarios that they would set up in Mission Impossible are not so extraordinary that they don't take place in a similar kind of vein in real life.
Now, could you tell us a little bit about who you think did, or where the evidence leads at, who did kill Mary?
Well, I think this was a CIA operation, and that she had been under surveillance for several weeks, and the order came down to take her out. And so, again, not wanting to wreck it for your listeners, because I think reading the book, there are some very exciting moments in it in terms of people beginning to see how they orchestrated this murder to make it look like just a random act of violence, when in fact it was nothing of the sort. This was a political assassination.
Is there anything that you haven't shared with the listeners that you'd like them to know?
Well, maybe one thing, and a lot of people are, I would say, intrigued and also ambivalent about the fact that Mary was a seeker, and she did dabble in the late 1950s, early 1960s with hallucinogenic substances. And she was really on the track, or sort of in the group of people who believe that these kinds of substances are sacraments, and that if they're used responsibly, they really can help people grow and evolve. And so she had experiences with both LSD and psilocybin. She sought out Timothy Leary for help in terms of how to guide people through these experiences. And so Timothy Leary appears in my book because he didn't realize what Mary Meyer was really up to, in the sense that one of her goals was she wanted President Kennedy to have a mild hallucinogenic experience, because she thought it would help him understand certain important matters of life, mainly that the pursuit of peace was the most important thing to pursue, not the pursuit of war or power. So I maintain, as does Leo Damore, that several weeks before this historic, important American University speech in June 1963, this Bay had a mild hallucinogenic journey at a mutual friend's house in Georgetown. I think it probably lasted 4 or 5 hours. And not that that was the main catalyst in terms of rearranging or changing JFK's life, but it certainly didn't hurt.
Yeah, I thought your book did a great job of showing how she influenced him in that direction of peace.
Well, in many ways, people need to remember that JFK was a man of his era. He had very set ways and beliefs about who women were and what they were supposed to do and what they were not supposed to do. And I don't think JFK had ever met anyone like Mary Meyer. She was not someone who was going to take any guff from any man. And I think Jack really came to understand that very quickly. And, of course, it was upsetting to him, and yet he was just so compelled by who she was that I think she became very alluring to him because, you know, he had a lot of problems with intimacy, particularly intimacy with women. I think in today's parlance, he would have what's called a sexual addiction. But I think his relationship with Mary Meyer was really a relationship of redemption where she was giving him the opportunity to, in a sense, be more of a complete person with her than he was anywhere else. You know, I don't think he was happily married to Jackie. I try and point that out in the book. Not that there's anything wrong with that, and I'm sure the Kennedys don't like that I dredged up all that stuff. But listen, we're all human, and, you know, if we were perfect, we wouldn't be here.
Right, and it's historical fact.
Yeah. And that doesn't make him a bad person. It was part of who he was. Believe me, most men of that era were just as bad. They just didn't have the light of scrutiny shining on them in the way that JFK did. And so this is just part of human evolution.
Well, Peter Janney, I really want to thank you for all of the research you've done, helping to put history, the true history, in perspective and in, before our eyes, and the history that's being hidden from us. And I will certainly be getting a copy of your second edition coming out in September.
Thank you very much, Cheryl. It was great to be with you this evening.
You just heard the conclusion of an interview with Peter Janney, author of the book Mary's Mosaic. The second edition is coming out in September with new information. I encourage you to check it out. And now for JFK's American University speech. Here's a paragraph from Mary's Mosaic about that speech. The president wrote his American University address with a small cadre of trusted aides who worked hard to keep its contents from the Cold War national security establishment. The powerful speech marked an abrupt departure from Cold War bluster and announced a new era of global cooperation and coexistence. Ascending the dais at 10:30 that morning, the president said, "I have, therefore, chosen this time and place to discuss a topic on which ignorance too often abounds and the truth is too rarely perceived. Yet it is the most important topic on earth, world peace." And here's the speech.
"For in the final analysis, our most basic common link is that we all inhabit this small planet. We all breathe the same air. We all cherish our children's futures. And we are all mortal. Third, let us re-examine our attitude towards the Cold War, remembering we're not engaged in a debate, seeking to pile up debating points. We are not here distributing blame or pointing the finger of judgment. We must deal with the world as it is, and not as it might have been, had the history of the last 18 years been different. We must therefore persevere in the search for peace, in the hope that constructive changes within the communist bloc might bring within reach solutions which now seem beyond us. We must conduct our affairs in such a way that it becomes in the communist interest to agree on a genuine peace. And above all, while defending our own vital interests, nuclear powers must avert those confrontations which bring an adversary to a choice of either a humiliating retreat or a nuclear war. To adopt that kind of course in the nuclear age would be evidence only of the bankruptcy of our policy or of a collective death wish for the world. To secure these ends, America's weapons are non-provocative, carefully controlled, designed to deter, and capable of selective use. Our military forces are committed to peace and disciplined in self-restraint. Our diplomats are instructed to avoid unnecessary irritants and purely rhetorical hostility, for we can seek a relaxation of tensions without relaxing our guard. And for our part, we do not need to use threats to prove we are resolute. We do not need to jam foreign broadcasts out of fear our faith will be eroded. We are unwilling to impose our system on any unwilling people, but we are willing and able to engage in peaceful competition with any people on earth. Meanwhile, we seek to strengthen the United Nations to help solve its financial problems, to make it a more effective instrument for peace, to develop it into a genuine world security system, a system capable of resolving disputes on the basis of law, of ensuring the security of the large and the small, and of creating conditions under which arms can finally be abolished. At the same time, we seek to keep peace inside the non-communist world, where many nations, all of them our friends, are divided over issues which weaken Western unity, which invite communist intervention, or which threaten to erupt into war. Our efforts in West New Guinea, in the Congo, in the Middle East, and the Indian subcontinent have been persistent and patient, despite criticism from both sides. We have also tried to set an example for others by seeking to adjust small but significant differences with our own closest neighbors in Mexico and Canada. Speaking of other nations, I wish to make one point clear. We are bound to many nations by alliances. These alliances exist because our concern and theirs substantially overlap. Our commitment to defend Western Europe and West Berlin, for example, stands undiminished because of the identity of our vital interests. The United States will make no deal with the Soviet Union at the expense of other nations and other peoples, not merely because they are our partners, but also because their interests and ours converge. Our interests converge, however, not only in defending the frontiers of freedom, but in pursuing the paths of peace. It is our hope and the purpose of Allied policy to convince the Soviet Union that she too should let each nation choose its own future, so long as that choice does not interfere with the choices of others. The communist drive to impose their political and economic system on others is the primary cause of world tension today. For there can be no doubt that if all nations could refrain from interfering in the self-determination of others, the peace would be much more assured. This will require a new effort to achieve world law, a new context for world discussions. It will require increased understanding between the Soviets and ourselves. An increased understanding will require increased contact and communication. One step in this direction is the proposed arrangement for a direct line between Moscow and Washington to avoid on each side the dangerous delays, misunderstandings, and misreadings of others' actions which might occur at a time of crisis. We have also been talking in Geneva about our first step measures of arms controls, designed to limit the intensity of the arms race and reduce the risk of accidental war. Our primary long-range interest in Geneva, however, is general and complete disarmament, designed to take place by stages, permitting parallel political developments to build the new institutions of peace, which would take the place of arms. The pursuit of disarmament has been an effort of this government since the 1920s. It has been urgently sought by the past three administrations. And however dim the prospects are today, we intend to continue this effort, to continue it in order that all countries, including our own, can better grasp what the problems and the possibilities of disarmament are. The only major area of these negotiations where the end is in sight, yet where a fresh start is badly needed, is in a treaty to outlaw nuclear tests. The conclusion of such a treaty, so near and yet so far, would check the spiraling arms race in one of its most dangerous areas. It would place the nuclear powers in a position to deal more effectively with one of the greatest hazards which man faces in 1963, the further spread of nuclear arms. It would increase our security. It would decrease the prospects of war. Surely this goal is sufficiently important to require our steady pursuit, yielding neither to the temptation to give up the whole effort, nor the temptation to give up our insistence on vital and responsible safeguards. I'm taking this opportunity, therefore, to announce two important decisions in this regard. First, Chairman Khrushchev, Prime Minister McMillan, and I have agreed that high-level discussions will shortly begin in Moscow, looking towards early agreement on a comprehensive test ban treaty. Our hope must be tempered. Our hopes must be tempered with the caution of history, but with our hopes go the hopes of all mankind. Second, to make clear our good faith and solemn convictions on this matter, I now declare that the United States does not propose to conduct nuclear tests in the atmosphere so long as other states do not do so. We will not be the first to resume. Such a declaration is no substitute for a formal binding treaty, but I hope it will help us achieve one. Nor would such a treaty be a substitute for disarmament, but I hope it will help us achieve it. Finally, my fellow Americans, let us examine our attitude towards peace and freedom here at home. The quality and spirit of our own society must justify and support our efforts abroad. We must show it in the dedication of our own lives, as many of you who are graduating today will have an opportunity to do by serving without pay in the Peace Corps abroad or in the proposed National Service Corps here at home. But wherever we are, we must all, in our daily lives, live up to the age-old faith that peace and freedom walk together. In too many of our cities today, the peace is not secure because freedom is incomplete. It is the responsibility of the executive branch, at all levels of government, local, state, and national, to provide and protect that freedom for all of our citizens by all means within our authority. It is the responsibility of the legislative branch at all levels, wherever the authority is not now adequate, to make it adequate. And it is the responsibility of all citizens in all sections of this country to respect the rights of others and respect the law of the land. All this is not unrelated to world peace. When a man's way please the Lord, the scriptures tell us, he maketh even his enemies to be at peace with him. And is not peace, in the last analysis, basically a matter of human rights, the right to live out our lives without fear of devastation, the right to breathe air as nature provided it, the right of future generations to a healthy existence? While we proceed to safeguard our national interests, let us also safeguard human interests. And the elimination of war and arms is clearly in the interests of both. No treaty, however much it may be to the advantage of all, however tightly it may be worded, can provide absolute security against the risks of deception and evasion. But it can, if it is sufficiently effective in its enforcement, and it is sufficiently in the interest of its signers, offer far more security and far fewer risks than an unabated, uncontrolled, unpredictable arms race. The United States, as the world knows, will never start a war. We do not want a war. We do not now expect a war. This generation of Americans has already had enough, more than enough, of war and hate and oppression. We shall be prepared if others wish it. We shall be alert to try to stop it. But we shall also do our part to build a world of peace where the weak are safe and the strong are just, We are not helpless before that task or hopeless of its success. Confident and unafraid, we must labor on, not towards a strategy of annihilation, but towards a strategy of peace.
This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.